Welcome to Attached, a platform for adding breadth and depth to everyday living. I'm Yaakov Danishevsky, and this is the conversation series focused on my book. In each episode, I invite a special guest to discuss the topic of a particular chapter and how it relates to our lives. Welcome to another Conversations episode. I'm joined here today by Professor Yoshua November, who I'm really delighted to have this conversation with. Yoshua is someone whose poetry I came across really pretty recently, actually. I was really, really taken by a poem that he wrote, an award-winning poem called Two Worlds Exist, and reached out to him and made this connection. Thank you so much for making the time to speak with me.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So we're going to be discussing the ideas in the book Attached, of course, and in particular, chapter 10 of the book, where I discuss the challenges of maintaining a long-lasting relationship in a way that still continues to have meaning, even as it lasts throughout time. Of course, it's natural that when something initially starts, there's more excitement, there's more of an energy to it, and over time, it can be challenging to keep that going and to find the meaning in the relationship. And so in these two chapters, 10 and 11, we're focusing on 10, I discuss different ways to try and maintain a meaningful relationship that can persist and have longevity. So I had asked you to look at a few of the different chapters and pick one that interested you. I'm curious to hear why this one in particular got your attention.
I think it's a very important topic, the idea of excitement waning and how to deal with it. In fact, I think that is actually one of the topics of art. Artists are always trying to capture how the sublime is in the ordinary and in the average everyday moment. And people tend to look for excitement and people tend to get habituated and they want something new. And then maybe they abandon a relationship that they're in and they fault that relationship and they feel that it's inferior or deficient in some kind of way. But perhaps what's necessary is to kind of discern the wonderment or the extraordinary within the ordinary, within the everyday. And I was fascinated by the strategies that the chapter laid out in terms of how to deal with boredom, lack of excitement. So the chapter is about relationships. It's about relationships with God, a Jew's relationship with God, or anybody's relationship with God, and maybe spousal relationships, and how in a spousal relationship or in a relationship with God, there's always kind of ebb and flow. There's moments of excitement and enjoyment and passion, and then there's moments that are more ordinary, maybe boring, or even disappointing or off-putting. And I thought it was fascinating how you relayed that the strategy to deal with that is what you call scaffolding, to institute or to put into practice certain routines where a person can make a schedule, let's say, to date, or even to put up the pot of morning coffee and switch off turns for that. And even though these things seem kind of mundane or even prescribed to say that we have to meet on this day, we have to have a date on this night, and it seems kind of lacking in romance, lacking in excitement. It seems like these things counterintuitively work. The scaffolding somehow works. Somehow doing these ordinary routines, although it seems unglorious, is actually what breathes new life into relationships. So I thought that was fascinating. And going beyond the spouse relationship, you link that to how in the relationship with a person trying to serve the divine, they also encounter a lot of routines, daily prayers, all kinds of laws, and so on and so forth, and how these laws and these routines also form the scaffolding in the relationship between person and God. And counterintuitively, it seems to work there also. So I thought that's really fascinating. And so I wanted to read a poem that maybe could help explore the mysticism of why that works. Why does scaffolding work? You mentioned in the book, in the chapter, that a mitzvah is a command, but it's also said to be a tzavtzav v'chibur, it connects a person. It doesn't just mean command, it also means connect. So it creates this bridge and this kind of bond. So I wanted to just kind of look at some of the mysticism behind it. I guess as a kind of intro, you might think about how sometimes there's things that are not as exciting, they're not as romantic or glorious, but something profound could still be happening, even though we don't process it, even though we don't register it, even though we might not feel enamored and excited, something very deep could be happening. In fact, something so deep that we can't feel it, we can't experience it. Another point, just before I get into the poem, is that in the beginning of the chapter, you quoted the Alter Rebbe. The Alter Rebbe is the first Chabad Rebbe, and you quoted how he speaks about how we want to feel, I'll just use the English, we feel our heart burning as a flame with desire and longing and passion for God. So that's very emotional, very inspired kind of experience that we all want and we all need in our relationship, I think. Famously, the Alter Rebbe also said that I don't want anything. Ich will gar nicht. I don't want anything. Ich will nicht dein Gan Eden, I don't want your Gan Eden. Ich will nicht dein Olam Haba, I don't want your Olam Haba. Ich will nur dich allein, I only want you. So what does that mean when he says, I don't want Gan Eden, I don't want Olam Haba, I only want you? In Chassidus, the terminology that's often used, Chabad Chassidus, is that there's God's essence, what's called Atzmus, to have experience of God, connect to God's essence, and then there's Giluyim, revelations, that which we feel. So that which we feel is exciting, and romantic and glorious. Atzmus, to feel God's essence, is not something that registers high on the excitement scale, but it's to touch something very profound. I think that's linked to the idea of scaffolding. So let me just read a poem before I talk too much. And maybe the poem will be a kind of segue into this idea of things that are not always exciting actually leading to profundity in relationship between God and in relationship between a person. So this poem is called The Infinitely Tall Rabbi Lectures on the Centrality of the Physical Deed. But the physical deed kind of reminds me of these ordinary activities that, you know, you might set up. One person setting up the coffee in alternating days. Similarly, doing these ordinary activities that we all do in Judaism that are very prescribed. And I kind of created this persona called the Infinitely Tall Rabbi as a way of kind of talking about Chassidus. So the Infinitely Tall Rabbi lectures on the centrality of the physical deed. It's the coffee and cake set up before the mysticism class, not the mysticism itself. Like love expressed in covering your wife's carpool shift versus the intrigue of glimpsing her in the library stacks one snowy October evening 20 years earlier. The physical gesture performed with the body is the only vessel that holds the divine. The universe, not a straight line with top and bottom at opposite extremes, but like a circle. The beginning is wedged in the end. The physical hand unzipping the velvet cloth and reaching into the tefillin bag reaches into God's private essence. So that's the poem. I mean, if you want to discuss it a little bit or have some thoughts on it, but any observations or any
really,
questions?
Really, I would actually, most genuinely, I would want to just hear you read it again and like sit here for half an hour without talking. It's really, really pretty enchanting. Is so much to say, but I guess we can start wherever you'd like with that poem.
Okay. So, I mean, the poem speaks about kind of what we talked about, how we all long for excitement and romance and energy in a relationship. And sometimes we don't have that, and things fall short. Maybe a good question to ask in those moments, is not like, what am I getting out of the relationship, but what am I giving to the relationship? Mm-hmm. Or how can I relate to this person in their deepest capacity, as opposed to me experiencing gratification from what they give me? How can I kind of connect to them? So in the poem, I talk about a young man perhaps seeing his prospective wife in the library and thinking she's, you know, beautiful woman, and that's exciting for him, but that's not really a connection to her in the most profound way. It's kind of superficial. The real connection comes in this 20 years later, in this ordinary moment when he covers her carpool shift. That's kind of like a relationship to her as she is on her terms versus, you know, the excitement that he wants. Now, again, you can't have a relationship with no excitement, obviously. It will be a dry run and you can't sustain it. But I think that counterintuitively, you find that when you're humble in a relationship and you try to think about what can I give this person in the relationship, that ultimately comes back to you. Not that you should be looking for that, but it does come back to you. And your spouse feels your contributions and your humility. And then usually if it's a good person, he or she will reciprocate. And that's probably why the two parties got married to begin with. I think it's also interesting because it's not like when a relationship goes sour or becomes stale, it's not like you're trying to reintroduce two people that don't know each other. These two people got married. They have an interest in each other. So they just need these activities to kind of bring out and refortify this connection that's already there. Mm-hmm. It's the same way, I think, in a relationship with God. Everybody has a soul. Soul considers it's a part of God. It's naturally there always. You can kind of cover it up and put rust and cake it over with dirt by not practicing things that will awaken it. But when you go back to pray, when you go back to do these routines, naturally, because the soul is a part of God and it longs for divinity, it will get excited through these routines. You're not creating something new. You're just kind of reintroducing, I would say. Mm-hmm. So that's why maybe scaffolding seems unromantic and boring, but it's probably just a method to unpack what's already there, to reintroduce what's already there.
So I could kind of think about this in a few different ways. I think maybe in a sense the way that I spoke about it in this chapter of the book is that the idea of scaffolding is that it kind of sets up the, hence the word scaffolding, it sets up the structure to allow the consistency and the stability of the mundane to be in place, mm-hmm. so that the moments of deeper meaning and higher connection can kind of drop in naturally.
Right.
And counterintuitively, the more that we have those prescribed, those routine, mundane scaffolding behaviors and rituals, the more that those natural, spontaneous moments will drop in. But what I think, which I think is an important idea, but I think what you're bringing out, part of what I'm hearing you speak about, is that there's another angle to it, mm-hmm. which is not only the scaffolding as a means to an end for when those more spontaneous, enhanced moments drop in, but that there's actually a way, and I think this is what you began with through the lens of art, that there's a way of looking at the mundane and in itself finding something that's more beautiful and more significant than we may have realized, which is what I loved about the end of the poem, for example, with the tefillin bag. So as a from observant male Jew, I put on tefillin 6 days a week for the past, you know, X number of years, and God willing, you know, for a long time, it becomes a very mundane thing. And then yet, the way that you captured it with those words, all of a sudden, it's like a whole different experience. And I think that's what you were saying a little bit about art as well, is that what the artist is doing is taking the very ordinary Sunday afternoon that you have a whole bunch of people by a pond, but then the way that they paint it and the way that they depict it, all of a sudden it becomes something exceptional, even though it's actually something quite ordinary.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think I am taking a different angle, and I'm saying that within the scaffolding itself, scaffolding is not a means to an end, but scaffolding holds something very profound. I agree with that.
Yeah, I think that's really, really amazing. I'm curious if you could elaborate maybe a little bit on
the divine,
the artistic process of like, how do we do that? Like, let's just say, for example, I'd be really curious if you're open to sharing this, like, what is the process for you of writing a poem, and how would that be kind of a mushal, so to speak, an analogy or an instruction for how a person lives that sort of artistic life, so to speak, whether or not they're an artist, but that they look at the mundane in their life and find a way to see the majesty within the mundane.
Yeah, I think maybe artists are naturally in tune to that. I think maybe artists are often highly sensitive people, and they react to stimuli in the environment maybe with more sensitivity, and they kind of just, I always think that artists kind of have this underlying sense of something wondrous in the ordinary. And I, that's also reinforced, I think, by learning Hasidus, Hasidic thought. In the Tanya, which we were speaking about, the Alter Rebbe's book, the Tanya, he raises an interesting point. He says that when we see a miracle, some kind of like a romantic, glorious, extraordinary moment, like the splitting of the sea, which is obviously a profound moment, and we look upon that and we are wowed, we are awed by the majesty of that moment. Nature has changed, God exists. But he says that really that's actually a lesser level of divinity. When God performs a miracle, it's a lesser level of divinity than when he recreates the world every moment. The world is recreated every moment, according to Jewish thought. We say it every day in our prayers. God is recreating the world every second, and not just every day, but tamid, always. So the world is brought into existence, yesh me'ayin, from absolute nothingness. And the Alter Rebbe says that's a greater miracle than splitting the sea. Because to take nothingness, to take something that doesn't exist whatsoever, and then recreate it, to create a physical reality out of nothingness, is a far greater miracle than taking a sea that already exists, and it naturally flows a certain pattern, and now he's just taking the pattern of something that pre-exists and changing that pattern. That's a lesser miracle than bringing something out of nothingness. So the ordinary moment is really, the divine is more present, so to speak, in the ordinary moment, more so than even a miracle. But to get back to the poem, I spoke about and I cited a line from the Sefer Yetzirah, which says, the beginning is wedged in the end, and the end is wedged in the beginning. The idea is really that the highest divinity, God's essence, what we call an atzmus, is actually most accessible or most present in the physical ordinary act, which in our case would be like the mitzvah. A good way to think about it maybe is like a circle. In a circle, you have, like, at one point, you have God's essence, and then you travel away from God's essence, you have all the spiritual worlds, there's various four spiritual worlds, and then at the end of the circle, you come back to the lowest physical world, this was called Asiya, and that, again, touches Atzmos, touches God's essence. So God's essence is actually most rooted and most connected to the physicality of the world. Surprisingly, counterintuitively, Chabad Chassidus at least argues that the most profound divinity is in the physicality of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when a person does this mitzvah, this act of putting on tefillin, for example, they will be touching God's essence. The beginning, God's essence, the highest spirituality is in the end, is in the physicality. Similarly, in the Lecha Dodi prayer, we say on Friday nights, we say that Sof Maisa B'Machshava Techila. Now that could be talking about creation. Shabbos is the last day of creation. But another way that the mystics look at it is that Sof Maisa, the physical act, the mitzvah, was B'Machshava Techila, was first in thought, was first mm-hmm. the thing that God imagined. The highest divinity, the first thought, the original stirring, is connected to Sof Maisa, the physical act. So that's the way that it is in the divine realm, in the relationship with God and us. Now, of course, we might say, I don't feel anything sometimes when I put on tefillin. But that might be a testament to the fact that you're experiencing essence. God's mm-hmm. essence is unknowable. The Zohar says of God's essence, leis machshava tefisa beklal, no thought can grasp it. So when we do a mitzvah, you're connecting to God's essence. This is his will. This is what he wants. You don't feel anything. Maybe because God is just being his unknowable self and you're connecting to that unknowable self. When you feel something and you're excited about something, that's the divine coming down into your finite vessels. That's what's called a contraction or it's symptom. And that means it's kind of almost like, you might even call it compromised divinity. Divinity tailored to what we can hold or feel or experience. So sometimes counterintuitively, in the act that we don't feel something, something very profound is actually occurring. And I think that's also true, maybe you could extend that to spousal relationship. It's said that everything in this world stems from a spiritual source. So marriage between a husband and wife stems from the marriage between God and the Jewish people, God and humanity. So if this dynamic is true when you talk about a mitzvah, ordinary act that God is commanding, then perhaps it's also true in a marriage, in a relationship. There's something profound and essential in doing this ordinary act for the other person, even if it's not exciting. It holds something that is very profound. It holds essence as opposed to giloi, essence as opposed to revelation. A little heavy, sorry, it's too heavy.
No, it's a lot to think about. It's I think that if I remember correctly, who knows, but I think that in chapter 13 of the book I discussed this in with regards to doubt, that almost when a person is unsure of God, they may actually be connecting with an even more true presence of God than when they think they know God, right? Which is based on this from the Alter Rebbe. Can I go back to what I asked you before? I'm curious if I can ask you to share the process of writing a poem.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, poetry is mysterious to me. I always feel like I'm kind of just starting from scratch, even though I may have written in many poems. I think it really depends on the poem. Each poem is like its own world. There's a lot of poems, maybe my favorite poems, that originate in, I would say they originate in an image. I see an image, and the image is striking, and I know that I will write about that. And then the kind of image cooks for a while in my mind, and then when I sit down to write it, it comes out very quickly and very smoothly. Mm-hmm. Then there's other poems where you kind of just have to manufacture. And you keep working on it, and you write part of it one day, and maybe you're not really sure about it, and you put it aside for another day, or even sometimes years. It could even take a couple of years to finally bring a poem to its ultimate state. I know in the book you spoke about artists, and artists who thrive are the artists who have a good routine. And you link that to kind of scaffolding and the people like Beethoven who kind of kept this schedule and regiment. He ultimately, through the regiment, he was able to produce really remarkable work, really glorious work. It actually reminds me of a teaching about, they often link the two sections called Matos and Mase. Matos means like a staff, and Mase means travels. So a staff is something that's kind of just rigid and dead and lifeless. And traveling is vigorous and exciting. But sometimes to get to traveling, to travel in your relationship, to travel in your spiritual life, you need the matos, you need the staff, you need the discipline, you need the kind of dry, everyday movements. And that's why those two Torah sections are often connected, matos and mase.
Is it true for you in your process?
In my poetry process? Yeah. I wish, honestly, that I was more disciplined and that I could just sit down and have a time that I write. Life just takes you in so many directions and pulls you in so many places, and so many responsibilities, that it's hard for me to be disciplined in that kind of way. I do know that when I do just sit down to write, and I try to have that discipline, usually something positive happens. And I do wish that I was a better poet. I wish I was a more observant poet, a more religious poet. that I think I would produce more work you definitely see that the end result of a poem that's strong, that's good, often is very different than when it started. In other words, when you started working at it, you had to go through all kinds of revisions and stages, certain poems at least, certain revisions, and you have to ask people because you don't have the objectivity to assess its quality. And you ask friends, where do I need to add an image? Where's the weak moment in this poem? So there's definitely a lot of input you need to get from others. Maybe also in a relationship it's good. The problem is that it's hard to write a good poem. Well, despite the appearances, it's hard to write a good poem. And when you sit down to write a poem, you so badly want to write a good poem. So that when you're writing it, you lose your objectivity and you think that what you're writing is good. And it may be good and it may not be good. Maybe it's, you know, similarly in relationship, you know, we get very stuck in our emotions and our ways of thinking of things. It's good to have a friend to talk to or a mentor, so that we don't get lost in our own thinking. Just like in a poem, you might think this is a great poem, but you're kind of just stuck in your own world and in your own head.
Do you ever find yourself hesitant to? I know that I have a struggle with this sometimes with writing or anything that I'm, kind of trying to produce. Do you ever have a struggle to show it to someone else in the fear of that kind of objectivity coming back in a way that, is not really what you want to hear?
You especially it's kind of demoralizing when you feel like you wrote something good and then you give it to somebody. But the truth is, you don't think that way because you're so self-assured when you think it's good that you think that your friend's going to think it's good too. So that's why you really get shell-shocked and blindsided when they tell you it's not really that good. It's remarkable how much we lack the objectivity. That's why also it's a good practice just to put it aside for a couple days. And then when you
Right.
come back to it, you see it in a fresh light.
And I think
So
all of this is such a helpful analogy to our avodas Hashem and to our marriages, right? To our relationship with God and with spouses, because that same kind of really, really blind subjectivity can set in. And maybe that's a big part of why in Hasidus and in Judaism in general, there's such an emphasis on having a mentor, having a Rebbe, having a friend, having that kind of sichas chaverim dialogue with friends and kind of getting that input. And I guess to the point I was bringing up, it's like overcoming that fear of getting the feedback that we don't want. And then I guess from the way you're looking at it is, I guess overcoming the assurance, the sense of confidence, right? So in one direction or another, but really getting that input from outside sources about the things that are really oftentimes so personal that we naturally wouldn't. So our relationship with God, our relationship with our spouse, the way that we're living, we don't necessarily naturally seek that out, but there's so much in Judaism that encourages that of us. And so kind of looking at all of this through the artist lens, like you're saying, it's interesting to hear about the significance and the importance for the artistic process, of the objective outsider input.
It's definitely vital. Even if you've written books and you're far along in your career, every poet is they're part of like a workshop with fellow poets, or they have a friend that they show to. There's a friend that I have, fortunate to have. His name is David Kaplan. He's also a poet and a Hasidic man, and he is a great resource for me because he's a good friend. But he kind of understands where I'm coming from, and he helped me tremendously with my books and giving me insights and perspective. I think there's less at stake in asking a poetry mentor for help than asking another mentor for in your personal life for assistance in your personal life. It is a scary thing. It's definitely a scary thing, and it's embarrassing a lot of times because there's certain areas of our life maybe we're embarrassed about, and we present ourselves in a certain way in the public eye, and we don't want people to see us in an unfavorable light. But it's very, very important to be honest, I think, in those areas. There's many times where I, in my own marriage, thought things were supposed to be a certain way, and I was convinced that I was right and it had to be that way. And then I spoke with a mentor, and they said, "No, you're wrong." I mean, and now again, a mentor doesn't mean you just listen to this person and they just tell you yes or no. You speak it out with them and you talk about your concerns. But we're not objective people, we're not. We're emotionally, we have a lot of emotional baggage. We have a lot of issues from our upbringing and certain bias. We just are not objective in the way, especially about our own situations. There's been, and even things that I've advised other people about, and then when I had the same experience in my own life, I wasn't able to follow my own advice.
Oh,
So
trust me, I have that all the time as a therapist. When we get
it's
off this call, I have about 5 hours straight of doing that.
I think it's so helpful just to be humble and realize we all need help. And in truth, it makes life much better, much less fraught with doubt. That's what the Pirkei Avos says. Say lecha rav, establish a mentor for yourself, the stalak minasafik, and you remove doubt. And there's nothing more joyous are gratifying in the removal of doubt. Mm-hmm. Doubt weighs on us so fiercely, so intensely. To know that you respect somebody and you could at least talk it out with them, even if you don't necessarily see eye to eye on what they're telling you in this particular area, it's great to have a mentor. Interestingly, even in my poetry life, I have a poetry mentors and I have spiritual mentors. And sometimes there's certain work that I write where I wonder if I should publish it, if it's fit, you know, for public consumption. And sometimes I myself am a stronger censor than my spiritual mentor. My spiritual mentor might say, well, you know, you're being too prudish or you're being too strict. And really, this is work that you should publish. Maybe it will help somebody. So even in that area, a spiritual mentor could even help in your poetry life.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, before we started the recording of this, we were talking just briefly for a moment about the Mittler Rebbe and the son of the Alter Rebbe, the second Rebbe of Chabad. And one of the things that he emphasized a tremendous amount, to my understanding, in addition to the general Hasidic emphasis on connection to a spiritual mentor, to a tzaddik, to a rebbe, the Mittler Rebbe emphasized the peer-to-peer relationships of that. His dream, I think the way they describe it, is that his ultimate dream was that two Jews would meet in the street and they would have conversations about their avodas Hashem and about Hasidus. And they would be talking about, here's what I'm working on and here's how this is going. And they would have that kind of dialogue and that openness with each other.
Right, right. I think he said that when two Hasidim encounter each other, one should be talking about Atik and one should be talking about Arach, which are two two very deep levels in this divine strata called Keser, which is God's delight in God's will. And they should be talking about that when they meet each other. But yeah, I certainly, Lubavitcher Rabbi, in addition to studying his teachings, he asked everybody a very heartfelt and strong request. Everybody should have their own individual mentor that they call and speak to every so often and just catch up and ask questions. I've asked my mentor many questions about marriage, about child rearing, about careers, and it's really been so helpful.
Yeah. As you quoted Pirkei Avos before, it's similarly and you mentioned before the embarrassment of sometimes getting that feedback or sharing that personal stuff. And in Pirkei Avos, it also says Ein Abayishan Lamed, right? That the person who allows that embarrassment to impinge on the choices they make won't be able to learn, won't be able to grow and explore that. I'm curious just to loop back to something you said earlier about the different ways that poems evolve for you. Mm-hmm. So sometimes they start with this image you said, and then it kind of flows from there. When the poems kind of travel on that course, on that path, is there still a lot of editing that happens afterwards, or do those are more kind of come out in just like a spontaneous inspiration?
There's not as much. I could read one. Should I read one of the poems that came out?
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So this is
the poem. First poem you read. Where can people find that?
It's in a manuscript I'm working on.
Oh, okay.
This poem was in my first book. It's called God's Optimism, and it's called Baal Tshuva's at the Mikveh. So a men's mikveh. Baal Tshuva is obviously of somebody who didn't grow up in a kind of religious framework, and they adopted that later, or maybe they did grow up that way. They left, and then they came back. And the mikveh is the ritual bath. And in Hasidic communities, men immerse in the ritual bath before prayer. So this is kind of a scene in the yeshiva where you have these men who immersed in Jewish life later on, and they have tattoos from their past. And tattoos, of course, are forbidden in Jewish law. So it's called Baal Tshuva's at the Mikveh. Sometimes you see them in the dressing area of the ritual bath, young bearded men unbuttoning their white shirts, slipping out of their black trousers, until, standing entirely naked, they are betrayed by the tattoos of their past life. A ring of fire climbing up a leg, an eagle whose feathery wingspan spreads the width of the chest, or worse, the scripted name of a woman other than one's wife. Then, holding only a towel, they begin once more the walk past the others in the dressing room. The rabbi they will soon sit before in Talmud class, men with the last names of the first Hasidic families, almost everyone devout since birth. And with each step, they curse the poverty that keeps the dark ink etched in their skin, until finally they descend the stairs of the purifying water, and beneath the translucent liquid appear once again like the next man, who, in all his days, has probably never made a sacrifice as endearing to God. So that poem is kind of just a rendering of what I saw. I remember being at the mikvah and seeing young men with very pronounced tattoos, and it was really a striking image to me. Incredible juxtaposition to see these people going to the mikvah, and they have these tattoos from their life before they inserted themselves into this new life. And I remember the image just being very, very striking. And I didn't write the poem for a while, but when I sat down to write the poem, it came very quickly, and I didn't revise it too much. That's really a poet's dream. Mm-hmm. A poet's dream is for the poem to just come like that. And that's, you know, something that's striking. And but there's other poems that I can't say that came as easily.
Mm-hmm. But even the ability, so I'm wondering, the ability to write a poem that amazing and really breathtaking in a moment and in a flash, was there a lot of training and development that had to take place before that? Or was that something you were just naturally able to do, like, you know, forever?
I mean, I went to school for poetry, studied poetry, I read a lot of poetry. But there's probably some kind of natural inclination that a person has that makes them want to write poetry. I do think everybody should write poetry, and everybody would benefit from poetry. A lot of people think that they don't like poetry because they've only seen poetry that's presented like it's like a riddle that they have to decode. But a lot of contemporary poetry is very accessible, and the meaning that's offered is the meaning on the page, and you don't have to decode it. So I think when people understand that, they realize that they could write poetry too, and they could tell their stories. Just like journaling is cathartic. Everybody wants to tell their story, and it's helpful for them to tell their story. But there's probably a certain inclination that a person has. I also think that living an introspective life probably helps you write poetry. And it's probably studying a lot of Torah and Chassidus or whatever you're studying kind of gives you an angle on things so that when you see them, you've filter and process the experience through that angle. I wasn't necessarily thinking about certain theological ideas when I wrote this poem, but hopefully the theological ideas that I study do become a part of my worldview. And so that when I see an event like this, it that worldview and those studies impact how I see it.
Again, part of why I'm focusing so much on kind of coming back again and again to your process of mm-hmm. poetry is because I'm really looking at this as a mashal, as a mm-hmm. framework for kind of living a poetic life, right? Living the artistic mm-hmm. life, which mm-hmm. as you framed early on in this conversation as being a way of looking at the regular world in a way that shines more, that there's more there than just the quick kind of utilitarian at the world, the technical look at the world versus what we're calling, let's say, the more artistic or poetic way of noticing and observing and experiencing all the phenomena that are already around us.
Right. Yeah. And I think that dovetails with Judaism. You know, Judaism is telling us to pay attention to the wondrousness of the world, pay attention to divine providence, pay attention to every small moment. It's all divinely orchestrated. There's no moment that's superfluous. I think maybe you could even take it a step deeper. In the Midrash tells us that God created the whole world because he wants a home in the lowest realm. That's a famous idea in the Midrash, and Chabad Chassidus seized upon that idea and took it as its thesis that the whole purpose of existence is God wants a home in this lowest realm. And that's why, maybe touches on what we spoke about earlier, that's why Judaism is so physically oriented. It's not a religion of celibacy. It's not a religion of asceticism. Our daily rituals are so steeped in physicality. But beyond that idea, so that when you do it, so when you do a command, like God instructs with the physical world, there's an idea in mysticism that a divine light is drawn down into that physical item and it becomes holy. And that's God dwelling in this lowest realm, God dwelling in the physical world. And in the Messianic era, once we've done all this work of purifying and refining the physicality through connecting it to these divine acts, then we'll see the divine openly manifest in the physicality. But another way to understand this idea that God wants a home in the lowest realm, and this I think relates to certainly to therapy and psychology, is that everybody in their own life has high moments and they have relative low moments. They have moments where they feel like they're failing and they're disappointed in themselves, and then they have moments where they're thriving and they're successful. And the way that we traditionally look at it is that we say the moments that I'm successful is good. The moments where I'm struggling or failing is problematic, and maybe I'm a disappointment to my friends and maybe even to God. I'm a disappointment to God because I'm not thriving in this area. I have this neuroses, I have this failing, I have this obsession. And we look at ourselves and want to say, God's not happy with me in that area. If I only didn't have that problem, I would be much better servant of God. But in this theology of the lowest realm, the idea is really that in that issue that you're having is really precisely where God wants to live. That issue that you're having is perhaps your whole purpose. This is why your soul descended, to deal with this issue. The things that you're thriving at is kind of like a gift from God. God made you good at those things, or he made it amenable so that you could work at them and you'll be good at them. The things that you're struggling with are really perhaps your life's purpose. And when you try to deal with them and try to overcome them, there you make a home for God in the lowest realm, in the lowest of the low. The phrasing that the altar abuses the Tanya in chapter 36 is Tachton Shein Tachton Lamat Mimena, the lowest point to which nothing is lower. He's talking about the physical world, but another way to apply it is in your own life. My lowest moments in my life are actually the opportunities to fulfill my life's purpose. That's really where God wants to dwell. And I can make God dwell there if I can keep going, you know, keep having faith, keep working at it, not giving up. The Alter Rebbe speaks about a person who maybe even has the same challenge their whole life. They have the same issue, and they never graduate from it. Now, you know, in traditional Western culture, we'll say that person's a failure. They never got over their issue. But the Alter Rebbe says that that person is a success. They just have to keep fighting and don't give up the battle. Keep working at it. And maybe that's why he was created. That's his whole purpose. So I think that's like that idea informs a lot of my poetry, where sometimes I speak about struggles that I'm experiencing in my poetry, sometimes even very personal family areas.
Which it's one of the aspects or themes of your poetry that I've really appreciated most is really just the vulnerability. There's so much personal revelation and expression that you share so generously, really, in what you write.
Yeah, that was a question. Should I be sharing some of those things? My feeling, and maybe I'm wrong, it was just my instinct that this speaks to this idea, that sharing those things speak to the idea that in the struggle is actually perhaps the whole purpose. And if you can come through it, then you've made a home for God in that lowest space. So that kind of inspired me to write this work, to do these things. Sometimes I even express doubt in the divine. And some people would say, how could you write about that? Why would you write that? Isn't that inappropriate? But I think that you have to also look at the person writing as a kind of commentary in the poetry too. If I'm going on, if I'm still living this lifestyle, then obviously it's a kind of commentary on how you should read the poem as well. And maybe that also speaks to what we started the conversation with. Like, there's going to be low moments in a relationship, but that doesn't mean it's a bad relationship. That's the moment that you can really actually encounter your spouse in a very deep and profound way. When everything is working out and everything is going well, you're probably just seeing yourself reflected in your spouse, or your spouse is validating and reiterating and mirroring all the things that you like. When there's a moment of conflict, that's a moment that you could actually have a connection with your spouse, as opposed to with yourself through your spouse, so to speak.
That's
there's no revelation.
That's a really profound way of looking at it. Wow.
Right, and that's the idea of an essence. You say, I don't want Gan Eden, I don't want Olam Haba, I don't want revelation, I don't want to feel good necessarily, I want to connect to you.
Yeah.
And again, the counterintuitive point is, you know, we shouldn't be looking for that, but it always does come back to us. And when we live that way, we ultimately get the most profound joy. Because we're humble, and when we're humble, I think we make ourselves a vessel for all kinds of blessings and connections to people.
So if I could just kind of summarize, I mean, there's so many kind of little insights that you've shared that I think are so profound. So I don't want to minimize any of that, but I guess the biggest kind of general piece that I'm walking away with from this conversation is that it is so striking and counterintuitive that of all the guests I've had on this series of this podcast, the first poet that I've had on is the person who chose to speak about the chapter of routine, discipline, scaffolding, and mundanity, which is just culturally the opposite of the way we think about artists poets. But really what you're saying is hagufa. Like that's the point, because the artistic way of life is not about the extraordinary per se. It's about the ordinary things and looking at them through the artist's view, the poetic way of living, which sees a flower, a regular flower, or a regular situation at the supermarket, or a regular morning at the mikvah, but sees something really holy, really beautiful, really extraordinary within that which would just seem so regular. And that really is so much of what we're trying to do in our lives when we live well, is the things that are the day-to-day, the regular, but to be able to pause and notice and observe and be enchanted by it and find the wonder and the curiosity and that which is extraordinary, but within the very regular, simple situations of our lives.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
So in closing, is there maybe one more poem that for whatever reason speaks to you right now to share with us, and then we'll...
I'll read another poem that perhaps reiterates this point about how what's exciting is not always means that you're connecting to God or the other person. It might be kind of connecting to yourself. So it's called The Deed, again, referencing the idea of the physical act. And the poem it has three sections. It kind of compares meditation, which might be gratifying and spiritual, to an uninspired mitzvah act. And it ultimately argues that the uninspired mitzvah act actually surpasses the meditation. Okay, so it's called The Deed. One, sunlight pours through the library window. Hours snowy dry from my family, I grade expository essays on the overlap between Buddhism and psychology to pay for my children's cheder tuition so they can learn texts in the holy tongue, which offer a different approach to happiness. Raised in a home where the Marx brothers played anarchistic pranks as background to family dinners, Roy Orbison's falsetto floating up from my father's Danish speaker, I tried to become a chassid. In which texts and whose voices do I carry as I shuttle between yeshiva and classes at the university? Between driving, grading papers, the children waking us each night, so little time for thinking, for learning, for love. Two, action, Rebbe taught, is the most essential thing, the deed prescribed by the infinite one, the only highway beyond the finite. The heart of a man meditating in front of a lake soars only as high as the human heart can climb. Yet, because it is a divine command, when he hears the shofar after the others have roused him, a worshiper who'd fallen asleep in the middle of services climbs the ladder, embraces the one without end. Three, perhaps this is why there are so few pious Jews in poetry. That profession of rowing through the rivers of the heart with oars made of memory and sadness. Four, the walls of the Rebbe's office absorbed sadder stories than any other room in the world. His heart was so full of affection, he cried in a synagogue full of bearded men in Brooklyn whenever he spoke of God's hiddenness. On my drive home tonight, snow circles under streetlights as the sedan ahead of me inches forward. My wife calls to say two of the children have done something she cannot repeat over the phone. When she hangs up a staticky recording of a discourse the Rebbe delivered decades ago, resumes. The worshiper must serve the divine, even if he feels or understands nothing.
No further comments.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you so much. Really, really a pleasure. Really amazing. Appreciate it so much.
Sure.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please follow us on WhatsApp, YouTube, or Instagram. All our podcast series can be found wherever you listen to podcasts. I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out with questions, comments, or suggestions, or to be added to our WhatsApp groups. You can reach us through email using yakov.attached@gmail.com or on WhatsApp at 773-888-2413.